Hello. In the previous audio snippet, we began to talk about the founding fathers who opposed slavery. And the idea behind this was to get a sense of how the atmosphere was prime or ready for the end of slavery after the founding of the state of Georgia. As we've said before, the process basically was that once the state of Georgia, which was born slave-free, was established, or the colony of Georgia, then there'd be a gradual end of slavery, so that by 1776, and then eventually 1788, America would be completely slave-free. But we went off that plan, that model, and we mentioned before how George Whitefield had a lot to do with that not coming to pass. The famous preacher who was responsible for or one of the forces behind the Great Awakening of 1740. So this person had a great deal of influence on how America would act and think in the years to come, but he became selfish and more concerned about his own works than about the future of this country. The plan got derailed, but that doesn't mean that there wasn't an atmosphere to do what was supposed to have been done. And that's why we're talking about the founding fathers who did oppose slavery. What we are trying to point out is that slavery was not some sort of accepted practice in American society that everybody was happy and okay with until the Civil War broke out. And I think that's one of the things that Democrats and the liberals try to make it sound as if America was just this slave-happy nation, and that didn't realize the evil or the wrong that was being done until many decades later. It was not like that at all. The atmosphere was ready or prime for the end of slavery. We just needed to have certain people push the nation over the edge so that we could be free of slavery. But it was like there were never enough people to promote the radical or the necessary change until we hit a point where we were, in a sense, forced to make the change, but even then, we didn't make it completely. We'll try to talk about that later in other audio snippets about how, after the Civil War, we didn't do what had to be done, and we're going to try to talk about the failures after the Civil War, why we didn't complete the task, and it took us all the way into the 1960s, 100 years after the Civil War, to bring some semblance of a true end to this caste society that we had in America, where black people were not allowed to function as American citizens in a full way. So we began to talk about very quickly about these founding fathers who opposed slavery, and we were mentioning seven of them. This list is from a website where we found a description of these people, so it might not be an exhaustive list, but they're probably the most influential of the founding fathers who were opposed to slavery. And we mentioned John Adams, the second president of the US. And we then mentioned Thomas Paine, who was in a sense, more English than American, even though he was instrumental in kickstarting the Revolutionary War through his Common Sense pamphlet. He never was like an American all the way through, in the sense of staying in America and then living out as an American citizen. He had a lot to do with helping America rebel against the British crown, but at the same time, he criticized slavery as he did, as he helped America become free of Britain, but he also worked to attack slavery back in England, in the British Empire. And then we talked about Marquis de Lafayette, who was also a foreigner, just like Thomas Paine, a very heroic man who I believe is not given enough praise in American history for the selflessness of his sacrifice. With no personal interest, he helped this nation become free and get established. And as he did that, he also was a very strong critic of slavery. And then we talked about Roger Sherman, who was the only founding father to sign all four of America's founding documents. And and let's briefly, quickly mention him again, in the sense that he signed the four founding documents, the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, the Articles of Confederation, and the Articles of Association. The Articles of Association was an agreement by the First Continental Congress in 1774 that was calling for a trade boycott against British merchants. So it was kind of the beginning of the separation. That was before 1776. So not too many people know about the Articles of Association, but that's one of the four founding documents. Then came the Articles of Confederation, that was kind of like a very loose union of the states. And then came the Constitution, which was a stronger union of the states, but still with the cancer of federalism embedded in it, as we've discussed so many times before. And then along with that was the Declaration of Independence in 1776. And all four documents were signed by this man, so he's relevant in that sense. Not too many people know about him. We mentioned that he proposed a bicameral system to end the deadlock during the Constitutional Convention, the Great Compromise. So we can see that he was a person who was basically willing to negotiate just to have a certain semblance of peace. And that's what federalism is an artificial peace of people who really don't get along. And that's part also of the problem of slavery in America, that we maintain that attitude. Okay, we have these parties that don't get along. Let's just do whatever it takes for us to have this tenuous peace. And that requires a lot of compromise. And that's part of what Roger Sherman was about. Even so, he was a consistent opponent of slavery. But he would be willing to make compromises with Southern states as long as, with Southern colonies, during the Constitutional Convention, as long as that's what it took to quote get the job done. And then we briefly mentioned Gouverneur Morris, maybe my personal favorite founding father. Who came from a slave-owning family, but never really owned a slave himself, and he was the person who wrote the preamble to the Constitution, the "We the People" paragraph that so many Americans are familiar with. He's the one who wrote that, And he was more of an advocate for a strong central government. And that's what we needed to end slavery. We could not end slavery through a weak central government. And I know conservatives always quake in their boots at the thought of a strong central government. But that's what is needed to enact certain things that are the right thing to do. What we need to do is to establish what is the right thing to do and have that right thing to do be applicable to all levels of government. The conservative solution is let's have a weak central government so that it will not be a tyrant over us, and let's have the state governments protected from the tyranny of the central government. But then the question becomes, who protects us from the tyranny of the state government? And the answer is no one. And the argument is sometimes made, well, state government is better because it's more local. But as I've, I believe I've mentioned before, what's the point of knowing that the tyranny is coming from a local government? I literally live one block away from City Hall, in the city where I live in Hoboken. That does not make a difference as to the stupid decisions that come from City Hall. Currently, the fact that it's local, that the government that's imposing stupidities is one block away, does not make it any better. If the government is run by tyrants, they will do tyranny, no matter what level they're in. And if we don't have a system that protects us against that tyranny at any level, then that is the problem, not the distance of the government imposing the tyranny on us, if that makes any sense. As some of you may know, Hoboken was probably the first place that the first city in the whole country that went into the lockdown nonsense. We were, it was right here. I was in the epicenter of the stupidity. And it didn't matter that I was nearby, the tyranny was imposed. That's what conservatives don't understand. That's why you have nut job states like California or Washington or Oregon that impose great tyrannies on their people, and the people have nothing that they can do about it. And the best that it can do is leave the state. And that's acceptable to conservatives. It's as if that means, oh, I can walk with my feet and just go to another state. Well, first of all, why do I have to leave? Why do I have to surrender and yield that territory? And second, if I leave, when will the tyranny end? Or is the conservative waiting for California to run out of population so that the tyranny in California will end? Is that the only solution? But obviously, a tyrant state can continue because people can get used to the tyranny. And the problem is the tyranny then just spreads out from that stronghold that happens because of the power of state government. Well, Governor Morris was for a strong central government, and he was basically, from what I can understand, the only one who very openly spoke out against slavery at the time of the Constitutional Convention, because that was the important moment. As we said, from 1732-33, when the colony of Georgia was established, up until 1776, we were to have like one phase of the ending of slavery. And from 1776 to 1788, the Constitutional Convention, that's when we were supposed to finalize it. So the Constitutional Convention was this last moment when we were supposed to have completed the task of ending slavery, but we didn't. And to have the document, the Constitution, be approved and signed and ratified without slavery being abolished was a monumental failure, a national failure. And it's like as if Governor Morris was kind of doing a last ditch effort to get the country to wake up, because time was literally running out, and it ran out without his warning being heeded. And then another of the founding fathers who was opposed to slavery was Alexander Hamilton, and we mentioned, if I'm not mistaken, before that he was a founding member of the New York Manumission Society, an organization dedicated to abolishing slavery in the state of New York. He never owned any slaves himself, and he was active in the passing of the Slave Trade Act of 1800 that was signed into law by John Adams in May of 1800. That was one of the last things he did. And John Adams, as we said, was one of the other founding fathers who opposed slavery. And we're going to talk about the Slave Trade Act a little bit later on. But for now, let's move on to the other founding father who opposed slavery, who would be Benjamin Franklin. And while Benjamin Franklin did own a few slaves as household servants for part of his life, and he was even also a promoter of slavery as a young man, because he would carry adverts for the sale of slaves in his newspaper as a young man. So even though he owned slaves and also promoted slavery by putting up adverts for slave sales in his newspaper, he eventually came to recognize the evils of slavery. And he actually freed his slaves, and he became a staunch abolitionist. He was president of the Pennsylvania Society for Promoting the Abolition of Slavery. That was a society dedicated to freeing slaves and to help them become better citizens. So it was a society about having black people be freed and also helping them once they were free to be, better, to kind of assimilate into American society better. And in February 1790, just 3 months before he died, Franklin presented Congress with a formal abolition petition. And this petition declared, quote, "Mankind are all formed by the same almighty being, alike objects of his care, and equally designed for the enjoyment of happiness." So just before dying, he presented this petition before Congress to have slavery ended. And then he died. And that was 2 years after the Constitution had been ratified, and George Washington was president of the United States. So we had a functioning republic, a functioning nation. So we were starting the country, and we still had slavery. And Benjamin Franklin did his last ditch effort to end slavery, to have Congress wake up to it, but it was to no avail. Because I'm not a big fan of Benjamin Franklin, but just like I'm not a big fan of John Adams, but when it comes to slavery, they were to be commended for their attitude and their effort. And they were part of that sense in America that this institution had to end. And I believe part of the problem was, if you could call it a problem, is that we never really understood fully, and I think we still do not understand fully, what slavery was about and why it had to end. Because when people would speak out against slavery back in the 1800s, they would speak out against it because of the evil, the cruelty, and a lot of those factors. But it was always from this perspective, more or less implicitly, the slavery should have never happened. And that was a bit of a problem, because slavery was supposed to happen. And as we've tried to explain before, slavery was a punishment, almost like a divine punishment on the black race in Africa, because of things we've discussed before. There were culture, there was evil going on there, a certain selfishness, and a certain cannibalism that was going on. And it's as if they a group of these people were taken prisoners and made to pay a debt to force them to do what they were supposed to do through their DNA, but were unwilling to. It's like these were people who were supposed to be sacrificial and were making a deliberate effort not to be sacrificial. People who were supposed to think about the future and were only thinking about themselves in the present. And people who had this conqueror ability and were using it to conquer each other instead of conquering and achieving great things. So that's why they were made prisoner. Slavery was sort of like a debtor's prison for black people, and it was an opportunity for a certain core of the black race to have a brand new start in the new world and to start with a new paradigm. But it was supposed to be for a season, and once the time ended, then they were to be set free and treated like brothers. And America didn't understand that. So no one ever explained it like that, that yes, this had to happen. We had to have slavery so that we could have this influx of black people in the country that would have never happened otherwise. But now we have to end it. If we had seen ourselves as the wardens of this prison and that the sentence had ended, it would have been easier for us as a nation, I believe, to kind of come to terms with it. Because there was this thing where some people wouldn't want to see the evil in it, because if they were told we have to end it because it's so evil, they would say, no, it's not that evil, because they would feel that there was a certain raison d'être for the institution to be there. So they didn't want to go all the way and go, okay, yes, we are evil, we have to let slaves be free. If they had understood that there was a mission in slavery, a national mission, then it might have been easier for a lot of people to then embrace the end of it. And it would also have been easier for America to then assimilate black people, because a lot of the people who oppose slavery, as we will describe, I think, in this audio snippet and in others, a lot of them were actually wanting to just let black people go back to Africa, which would have defeated the whole purpose of why we had slavery to begin with. Part of it was so that we could have this tremendous influx of black people in the country to could totally change the culture, the nature of this nation. As I've said before, this nation was built on two races or two ethnic groups. I despise that term, but for lack of a better term, two ethnic groups or two groups of people or cultures, the white Anglo-Saxon and black, the black race and black people. Those are the two foundational races of this country. And every other race, every other person or group that has come has been like the icing on the cake. But the cake, you know, without the icing, the actual dough that forms the American cake is those two people, Anglo-Saxon whites and blacks. And so without black people, America would have never been what it was supposed to be at all. And it's a shame that no one has ever transmitted that concept to black people to make them realize, hey, you are the part of the foundation of this nation. You are what makes America America. And if they were aware of it, because it's not just a thought just to make us feel good. That's the reality, the metaphysical reality of this nation. And if Black people were told that, they would have this sense of identification with this country and say, yeah, we are Americans. We're not Africans who just happen to be in America. We're just Black people who live in this country. No, we are part of what this nation is all about. We are Americans. And that would do a lot of healing, internal healing, when embracing that reality. But because no one understands that, it's as if this reality has been lost. So it's important that it was important for people back in the 1800s to have understood why slavery had to be and why it had to end, because it not only would have kind of helped in the internal healing or absorption of the idea we have to end slavery, and it doesn't mean that we were evil to begin with in having instituted it, but it would also have prevented the attitude that some anti-slave people had of just wanting Black people to go back because they were just not easy enough to assimilate as other people. So they just felt, you know, Black people and white people just can't get along, and they're too different, and we just have to ship them back, but we have to end slavery. But as we said, that would have defeated the purpose. So now that we've briefly mentioned these people, let's quickly start talking about the acts, the legislative acts that began to happen in America and Britain as the 18th century was ending and we were entering into the 19th century, because by that time we should have had slavery over in America. So the doors were opening. That's what we're trying to portray or point out here in these audio snippets. The door to the end of slavery was just opening up in America and around the world. We just didn't walk through the door, but the door was wide open. So we mentioned that Alexander Hamilton was active in the passing of the Slave Trade Act of 1800 that was signed into law by John Adams in May of that year. And interestingly, that Slave Trade Act was also promoted by Jefferson. If you read some of the things that Jefferson wrote about slavery, you would be surprised because when people think of Jefferson, they think, oh, slave owner, and he slept with one of his slaves and had these illegitimate children that has been, I think, certified through DNA tests and stuff. We tend to think of him as this evil Southern slave owner, pro-slavery. But he criticized slavery a lot. He criticized the slave trade. He thought it was evil and all that. So you read a lot of his things and you go, my goodness, how could he then turn around and still own slaves? But it was this kind of like dichotomy that he had, like a Jekyll and Hyde thing. These two parts that were there. It's like he knew that it was evil, but he still didn't want to get rid of it. And as I said, as we said just a moment ago, if we had understood that slavery had this like two sides to it, yes, it had to exist. Evil as it might have seemed, slavery was necessary. It's a punishment for the Black race. And then at the same time, say, yes, the punishment had to end. Just like, you know, when you commit a crime, you go to jail or go to prison, and you're sentenced to X number of years, once the X number of years are up, if the warden doesn't let you out of prison, then he becomes liable, morally liable, because now you're being imprisoned or kidnapped against your will. And that's kind of what we did with Black America. They were supposed to be let go, and they were not let go. And just as another side note, let me just repeat that for those who are Christian who are maybe listening to this, slavery as a sentence on a race of people is not like a crazy anti-Christian idea, because in the Bible itself it talks about the God of Israel in a sense allowing, or in a sense sending his own chosen people, the Jewish people, into slavery for 430 years in Egypt. And if you look in the Bible, you can see there's a trace of almost like an explanation of why that had to happen. Because it was a punishment on the Jewish race. There was something inherently wrong that they were doing. And as a result, the punishment was being in Egypt, according to the Bible, if you look at the Bible. So it's not a kind of a crazy thought to think that a race of people would deserve as a punishment to be enslaved. Just look at the Jewish people, and that does not mean that you are thereby decreeing a certain race as inferior. Because why would the Bible validate the slavery of Jewish people for 430 years when it at the same time says that the Jewish people are the chosen race according to the Bible? So being sentenced like that to a sentence of slavery does not mean that you are declaring that race inferior in any way. It's just part of the process. If you do the crime, then you do have to do the time, in a sense. And that's what was happening. So if we had understood that dichotomy, then I think people like Jefferson would have been much more open to then saying, okay, yes, we have to end it now. But we didn't have that sense. And we still don't, unfortunately, because saying something like slavery had to happen, it seems so contrary to everybody's thinking, especially nowadays. But that was the reality. That is the reality. Because if you deny it, then you practically are saying black people should all go back to Africa. They should have never come here to begin with. They should have never grown up in America. And that would obviously be a stupid thing to think. And that's basically that shows how stupid it is to not recognize the need for slavery. It had to happen, unsavory as it is, to admit that. Now, going back to the Slave Trade Act, which was promoted by Jefferson, it was signed into law, and before that, there had been another Slave Trade Act of 1794. So we're talking like 6 years after the Constitutional Convention. Washington was still the president in his second term. And this Slave Trade Act outlawed the international slave trade on U.S. vessels. And limited the trade of foreign ships on U.S. ports. So there was a Slave Act in 1794 that started limiting the slave trade, and then came the one in 1800. These acts limited America's involvement in the trade of human cargo. The one in 1800 extended the limitations of 1794 by limiting Americans' involvement in the trade of human cargo by increasing fines and penalties, and outlawing U.S. citizens and residents' involvement in the slave trade or the employment of U.S. citizens on foreign vessels. So the 1794 Act just outlawed the slave trade on U.S. vessels. So foreign vessels were still allowed to do slave trade. But they were allowed to do it in a limited way. But the Act of 1800 kind of outlawed it outright and said on foreign ships or U.S. ships, there can be no slave trade, and no U.S. citizen is to be involved in the slave trade, if it happens, they are to be fined or I don't know, there was a prison sentence on it, but it was illegal for a U.S. citizen to be involved in the U.S. In the slave trade, even if he was doing it for like foreign a foreign company or foreign ships. So and that's kind of a shocking thing to think about, because we all think that slavery was okay and accepted, fully accepted and embraced. But by 1800, we in America had said no more slave trade. Jefferson spoke out about the evil, how evil it was to do that, snatching a black person from Africa, separating them from their family, and dragging them in that horrible trip with many, many slaves died on the way across the Atlantic. So we all were aware of how evil it was, and we ended it in 1800. And that's how open the door was to ending slavery, that we were willing to do that. Even as slavery continued. And then after that came the Act Prohibiting Importation of Slaves in 1807, which again was promoted by Jefferson, and he was the president at the time. And, he was the third president. So he was, I think he was president from 1801 to 1809, more or less, at the very start of the 19th century. So he promoted this act, and he even promoted in his State of the Union of 1806, and which seems kind of like a very odd thing. You think of Jefferson as a slave, evil slave owner, but he was speaking in his State of the Union, promoting this act, saying this is very important that we sign this act prohibiting totally the importation of slaves. So it was this act prohibiting the importation of slaves of 1807. And that basically made all trade, even by foreign ships, a federal crime. Because I, if I'm not mistaken, the act in 1800 kind of limited U.S. involvement in the trade, but still foreign ships could bring in slaves. The act in 1807 said nothing. No. Even if the slaves are being handled by foreigners altogether, they cannot be traded into the country or brought imported to the country. It was enacted on the 2nd of March of 1807. And that year was very important somehow for when it comes to slavery, because Britain passed its own Slave Trade Act of 1807 in the same month and year, in other words, in March of 1807. And just so you know, slavery was not allowed on English soil by English law. And that was certified by a famous case called Somerset versus Stuart. It was a legal case in 1772. And I think it had to do with a person who, a black man who, that someone was trying to get to grab and take to Jamaica to make him his slave, and this lawsuit had to do with questioning whether it was legal for them to do that. In other words, there was no slavery in England, but there was this man who wanted to enslave this person and take him to Jamaica. I guess his argument was, I'm not going to have him as a slave in England. I'm going to have him as a slave in Jamaica, just taking him from here. And the ruling in 1772, mind you, that was before the Declaration of Independence. We were still a British colony. We were still a British territory. And even then, in England, which was supposed to be the evil tyrant oppressing the Americas, they were saying, you will not touch a black man here. If the black man is on English soil, he is free. You cannot enslave him, even if you're going to make him a slave in Jamaica. You cannot kidnap him here. So there was no slavery on English soil, but it was still allowed in the colonies or you know the territories of the British Empire, there was a committee for the abolition of the slave trade that was formed in 1787. Remember, 1787 was the year of the Constitutional Convention in America. So as we were drafting the Constitution, there was this committee in England that was set up for the abolition of the slave trade. It was set up by a group of evangelical English Protestants who allied with the Quakers in England and formed this strong committee saying we have to end slavery. And remember, this is why we're talking about the spiritual, like this almost spiritual door that was opening for this country to end slavery. We had to end it by 1788. That was like the deadline. And even England was aware of it. And they formed this committee. In Parliament, the anti-slavery forces were led by a man called William Wilberforce. And it's very important to know him. He's a very important man in history. William Wilberforce, he took on the cause of abolition in 1787 after apparently having read the evidence that a person named Thomas Clarkson had amassed against the trade. So he read about the horrors of slavery and the slave trade and said, we have to end this. And even though there was no slavery in England, think about that. It's not like he was seeing slaves every day because there were no slaves to see in England. But even so, he knew that slavery was going on elsewhere in the British Empire, said we have to end it. And he became active against it. He and those who were with him saw abolition as a almost like a divinely ordained battle. So they believed that this was ordained of God. That they had to do this. They were aware of this. In 1787, I hope I'm emphasizing this, there was a door that was opening, a door of opportunity, and we were not taking it. And just to give you an idea of Wilberforce wrote in his diary on Sunday, the 20th of October, 1787, he wrote, quote, God Almighty has set before me two great objects, the suppression of the slave trade and the reformation of manners. And I'm pretty sure the reformation of manners is something formal, because when I read it, I think of, oh, is he talking about reformation of table manners? Or I'm not sure what he's talking about. I'm certain that must be a very specific thing that I'm not aware of historically. So he had these two causes. He said, God Almighty has set before me two great objects, two great goals, you could say, the suppression of the slave trade and the reformation of manners. So it was a divine thing. There was an awareness that people had, this has to end, the time has come. And it's also important to mention that as that was happening in England, In the Americas, we also had slavery ending. There was the Act Against Slavery of 1793 that was passed by the Parliament of Upper Canada in British North America. So remember, we had already, you know, become a free nation with a president. You know, George Washington was the president in 1793. So we had a president, the Congress, a functioning nation already, that had been freed from the tyrant, Britain. And at the same time, the tyrant, Britain, in its Canadian colony, was enacting an act against slavery in 1793. And this act abolished the slave trade. It freed up slaves immigrating by choice or force, as well as children born to enslaved women subsequently upon their 25th birthday, but it didn't emancipate existing resident slaves. So it didn't end slavery altogether, But it did set free the children of slaves upon their 25th birthday. So that was in 1793 in Canada. And then we had the Slave Trade Act in 1794 in America. But it didn't go as far as the one in Canada. And also later on into the 19th century, there was this... as Wilberforce and all these people in England started fighting to have slavery terminated, you know, they passed the slave the Slave Trade Act of 1807, but they didn't just end it there. Britain was in this constant effort to end slavery everywhere, and they started doing treaties with different nations to start kind of like. And like stemming the tide of slave trade around the world. So, for example, England did a treaty with Portugal, the Anglo-Portuguese Treaty of 1810, in which Portugal agreed to restrict its trade into its colony. So what was the problem if the Portuguese were doing slave trading? It's like you could say, Britain could say, that's not my problem, but they made it their problem. And because the Portuguese were very active in the slave trade, we talked about that. They were the main bringers of black people into the Americas, mostly into Brazil. That's why Brazil has such a large black population. Brazil has a lot of things that are very similar to America. A lot of people, especially in America, are not aware of that. But Brazil is sort of like a Portuguese America. In many ways, it's a melting pot of people from many nations. It has this history of slavery and a strong black population that has also shaped the flavor of the nation. Brazil would not be Brazil without black people. It has a strong European influence. It's not like the other Hispanic nations that had a lot of Amerindian influence. It's mostly... Europeans and blacks with a little bit of Amerindian, but not as much. So it's almost kind of like America. America is mostly was founded on Europeans and blacks. So Brazil has a lot of similarities, and I guess in a sense that explains why Brazil had its version of Trump. It still has its version of Trump running around, a version that's much better than the American version of Trump, Jair Bolsonaro. But the thing is that the British did this treaty with the Portuguese saying, okay, you're going to stop your slave trade. And then they also did a treaty with Sweden in 1813, 3 years later, the Anglo-Swedish Treaty of 1813, in which Sweden accepted outlawing its slave trade. The English also did a treaty with the French, the Treaty of Paris of 1814, whereby France agreed with Britain that the slave trade was, quote, repugnant to the principles of natural justice, unquote. And they agreed to abolish, France agreed to abolish its involvement in the slave trade in 5 years. And in the 1814 Anglo-Dutch Treaty, the Netherlands outlawed its slave trade. And in the 1817 Anglo-Spanish Treaty, Spain accepted suppressing its slave trade by 1820. So you see during the after 1807, over a 10-year period, Britain was making treaties with all these other countries to get them to end the slave trade as well. It's like they were saying, no, it's not enough that we end it. The other element, other participants of the slave trade have to end it. And they were actively kind of working to get that ended with the Portuguese, with the Swedish, with the French, the Dutch. The Dutch had a lot, were very active in the slave trade, and the Spaniards. So as we're, what we're trying to say, over and over again, the door of opportunity was opening. Even the British were ending slavery, the slave trade, were working towards ending slavery, and we were not. And eventually it came So this was ending the slave trade, but the actual end of slavery was done in England in the Slavery Abolition Act of 1833, which called for a gradual abolition of slavery in most parts of the British Empire. Everywhere in the British Empire except for the parts owned by the Dutch East India Company, and also in the territory of Ceylon, which is, I believe, in modern-day Sri Lanka. So they were excluded, but the rest of the British Empire would see the end of slavery. But it was not like an outright, okay, slavery's over, slave, the next morning you're going to be free. It was a gradual abolition of the slave trade. And that is the way it was supposed to be, as we said before. We were supposed to start a gradual end of slavery from 1732-33, when Georgia was founded, until the Declaration of Independence, and then like a final push into 1788, when the Constitutional Convention was held and the Constitution was ratified. So there was never an abrupt and solution for slavery. It had to be gradual, and this act recognized that. It was passed on its second reading on the 22nd of July, 1833, just a week before Wilberforce died. So William Wilberforce, I think black people are not aware of how important this man was to the freedom of black people around the world, and he should be recognized for that. William Wilberforce kind of was divinely given this time to see this act pass before he died. And then this act received the royal assent. In other words, the crown signed it, you could say, or agreed to it on the 28th of August of 1833. And it came into force the next year on the 1st of August of 1834. And only the slaves that were below the age of 6 were freed outright. So if you were up to, I don't know if it included the year, the age of 6, but let's say up until the age of 5, if you were 5 or younger before 1834, you were legally not a slave anymore. So you were free. You might be growing up in a slave household, but you were free, legally free, and treated legally as a free citizen. Slaves over the age of 6 were redesignated as, quote, apprentices. So there was this shifting. Okay, you're no longer a slave. Now you're an apprentice. You're part of this workforce, but you're in this special category that we're going to call apprentices. And the act called for 2 stages. First, a 4-year stage, because it was put into action, or it came into force on the 1st of August of 1834. So up until the 1st of August of 1838, that was the first stage, 4 years. And then there was the second stage from 1838 until the 1st of August of 1840. There was a 4-year stage and then a 2-year stage. In the first stage, the act provided for payments to slave owners. Because that was one of the problems with ending slavery, what do you do with the slave owner? Because you could say, well, slavery is kind of like you're paying people a very low wage because you're feeding them, you're housing them, you kind of paid a fee to acquire them and have them in your plantation. But why not just turn that into a salary? But the part of the problem was that if you pay a large amount of money to a slave trader to own the slave, then that money is gone. Who has that money? The slave trader. That's why it was so important to end the slave trade first, because that ended the made it very difficult to make the transition of having a slave to having a worker with a wage. That because then the slave became an investment, owning the slave, because then if he had children, then the children, you own the children. Sounds so horrible to say that, but you own the children, and then you, it's like raising cattle, like, oh, you now you have more cattle, more, and then you can sell part of that cattle to someone else and so forth. So the slave trade, in the trading of slaves, there was this group of people who were profiting and pocketing the money, and there was a sunken cost in a sense. And if you just liberated the slave, then the person who bought the slave would have that initial investment lost because it was in the pocket of a slave trader, not in the pocket of the slave. The slave was not getting that money, which is what happens when you hire someone. When you hire someone to work, you put money into the employee's pocket for him to work for you. But in this case, you're putting money into the pocket of a third party who is not working for you. He took your money and ran. He's like the recruiter, if you can say it like that. Say it that way. It's just like when you, oftentimes a company hires a recruiter to fill a position in the company. The recruiter gets a fee for having gotten you to work for the company. But the fee in this case was exorbitant. And that's why there had to be an issue of financial compensation to kind of make it easier for slave owners to absorb the shock of having to let slaves go. And this act provided for that. There was money allotted for that, and for the sum of 20 million pounds. Think about that. That was equivalent to 5% of the British GDP at the time. Or as said another way, it was 40% of the British Treasury's annual income. Imagine that. If we in America had like present day 5% of the GDP, I'm not sure how much that is, but it could be maybe $600 billion or... sorry if I have the math wrong on that, but it's a whole bunch of money that the British Empire decided to set aside to end slavery altogether. It's a shame we didn't do that here. And if we would have done it, it would have cost us a little bit, but the karma, if you can call it that for lack of another term, the karma that would have been brought upon the nation would have more than compensated for the temporary loss. We would have made it up. And we ended up fighting a war, a five-year war, civil war, that killed 600,000 Americans and cost who knows how many billions and billions of dollars. So we ended up paying the price anyway. And along with years of conflict and turmoil and moral shame. And then we continued with that way into the 20th century. So it would have been just easier to pay up front. And that's what the British did. And because they had to get the money somewhere, they took a $15 million loan. So to cover 15 out of the 20 million pounds. For this slave compensation fund, and it was finalized, or slave owner compensation fund, and this loan was finalized on the 3rd of August of 1835, and with a banker, Nathan Mayer Rothschild, and his brother-in-law, Moses Montefiore. And I know the Rothschild, that's like an evil name a lot of conservatives, especially in America, who talk about the Rothschilds. But it's interesting that one of the Rothschilds was involved in providing the money to help free slaves. You can make whatever you want of that, but that's just the historical fact. And I don't know what to make of it myself. But the thing is that they provided this loan And the other $5 million were paid out directly in government stock, and that stock is would be worth like $1.5 billion in present day money. And so this money was made available, and slave owners were compensated as slaves were being set free. And when the act was passed, people in England protested against the apprenticeships, but not because they were against slaves being free. They were opposed to this transition thing. In other words, they wanted slaves to be free outright as quickly as possible. So the people began protesting very peacefully. It was never violent, but they were very loud and protesting. And it continued until the apprenticeships were abolished and full emancipation was granted on the 1st of August of 1838, 2 years ahead of schedule. So in other words, the two-stage process was cut off to just one stage. It was supposed to be a four-year stage and then a two-year stage. And because of all the protests in England, they said, oh, okay, forget about it. Forget about the last 2 years. At the end of 1838, all the slaves are fully free, and that's how it happened. They were able to make it happen throughout the British Empire, throughout the whole British Empire, a large British Empire. We couldn't do it here in how many colonies had slavery? It was Maryland, I think, Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina, and Georgia. I believe those were the main states that had slavery, main colonies. So five little colonies, and we couldn't do it. They were able to do it in the entire British Empire, the humongous British Empire, and we couldn't do it. That just goes to show you that we were not willing to do what had to be done. And we're going to start talking about how, as Britain was setting slaves free, we were entrenching ourselves in slavery, and how we're going to talk about a couple of people that were very important in not ending slavery, not because they were for slavery, but because they were unwilling to act and do what had to be done. Two very important people. And then we'll talk about a third one who was actively fighting to end slavery, but his attempts went on deaf ears, mostly because the other two, I believe, we're not helping. So we'll do that in the next audio snippet. And do bear in mind that the reason why we're saying all of this is so that we can have an awareness of what we missed so that we can repent of it. We have as a nation, go back and look at it and say, yes, we should have done it then. And conservatives don't want to do that because to them it's like, oh, we already fought a war and it's over and we should move on. But the fact that we are to this day even honoring Robert E. Lee and Jefferson Davis and people like that who were Confederate traitors. Robert E. Lee was a traitor. Traitor to humanity, traitor to morality, traitor to his maker, a traitor to the country by supporting the Confederates and helping them to fight the North for 5 years. And the fact that we still honor him, this son of a bitch traitor who I believe is burning in hell as we speak, and that worthless little bastard boy Jefferson Davis, the president of the Confederacy. They have statues of them in the South, throughout the South. It's like, how the hell do we have, that means that we have no awareness of what we did wrong, no awareness. We still don't understand. It's like, oh, that's part of our history. Well, as I've always said, well, then should Germany have statues honoring Hitler and Joseph Mengele? It's part of their history too. No, they don't have those statues because it's a shameful part of their history. They're not going to honor that. And so we haven't dealt with it. again, because there's also this understanding, well, then, no, we, it's like part of the American deep inside knows slavery had to happen, but is never willing to verbalize it. So we need to go back and say, yes, slavery had to happen, had to end by this time. And every second that we didn't end it at the time we had to end it is, we are accountable for it as a nation, especially in the South, which not only didn't end it, when it had to end, it didn't end it after slavery, after the Civil War ended. It kept holding on to that slavery spirit up until 1964, the Civil Rights Act. Even then, it was still fighting it. And I don't know, there was a point, maybe in the 70s, I don't know when it happened, maybe in the 80s, when finally the South just let go of slavery. But it's still clinging to, but it's still like a stupid little boy who doesn't understand the history of it and has no remorse over it. So it's like, it's this attitude of, okay, it happened. I wasn't here when it happened. Let's just move on. And you can't do that. You have to recognize what happened. And then say it publicly and recognize it and then move on. But we haven't done that. And that's why Black people were never restored as a people in America. But I do believe there's a future for Black people in Britain, because Britain acted differently. And I think that we will hopefully see in the years to come a manifestation of the calling of Black people in Britain as a people in ways that I wish we could have seen here in America, but we will not see it, because Black people are lost as a people, gone. There might be a few individuals who might transcend and succeed and excel, but as a people, that great calling that Black people had was gone, not only because of how the white race didn't act as it had to, it's also because it was compounded by how Black people reacted as well. And Black people didn't rise up to their calling. It was made more difficult by what white people did, but it's still, you're still responsible for your own actions. Everyone is the architect of their own destiny. And Black people have failed on their own too. And we will never see the greatness that we would have seen, and it grieves my heart. You have no idea how much it grieves my heart to realize how the greatness that Black America was going to exhibit will never happen. Never happen. It was going to be amazing. I wish people could see it, could see what Black America would have turned into. It would have been incredible. It would bewilder the nations of the earth to see the shining of the Black race in America and see all the great things that would have been done through the Black race. Yeah, you could say, yeah, a lot of it has happened already, but not what I'm talking about. Not in its full shining level. And we might get to see some of that in Britain in the decades to come because they acted differently. But we still have to recognize and deal with this, because even though the dream is lost, the dream is dead, we still have to fix what needs to be fixed so that it doesn't turn into even more of a nightmare. So we might have a semblance of normality and peace at the end. We have to deal with this anyway, even though the game has been lost. The game is over, we lost, and there's nothing we can do about it. But we still can minimize the damage by understanding what happened. So that's why we're going through all of this. Thank you very much for listening.